Hello and welcome to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, along with Josh, of course, our co-host, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. And this is a program we'd like to do most Fridays. Let me get it right off the top here. We won't be available next Friday, as we just won't be able to do it next Friday. So we'll be off next Friday, and hopefully we'll resume the following Friday. Depending on, there's a holiday in there somewhere. We'll figure that out. Anyway, I'm getting all charged up here, Josh. What do we have on tap here for today?
We have Amanda Orlando Kesterson, chairwoman of the Gloucester Republican City Committee, who's going to be on and talking about the presidential election. Eileen Duff, a candidate for Governor's Council, will be talking about her herself and her role with the Governor's Council. And she'll also talk a little bit about the presidential election from the Democratic perspective.
And we'll have Kate Fox, Destination Salem Executive Director, on talking about haunted happenings, among other things, in Salem. All that's coming right up here on Trending Now.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Amanda Orlando Kesterson. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's been a eventful week, I guess, another chapter in the presidential race. What are your observations of the past debate and where the election stands to date?
Well, I thought the last debate was the best of the three. I thought the moderator was the best. Chris Wallace did a really good job. Appropriately challenging both candidates equally. I thought his questions were really good. They were substantive. They were on the issues that actually matter. He discussed the Supreme Court. He discussed the immigration. He discussed national security. He talked about some Clinton issues in addition to some Trump issues. So I thought it was the best debate. I thought the candidates both did well. I thought Trump was really, really good. I thought he had his best debate of the three. So I think it was good, and I think the fact that it was the last one is very important because it's what's going to be in people's heads in 2 weeks when they go to the polls.
What do you think, what were the expectations for Trump going in, and did he meet those? There were some analysts that have said that they thought, given the disparity in the polls, that he really needed a knockout punch, if you will, if you use the boxing analogy, and that he didn't get that, but he did commandingly well.
I thought he did commandingly well. I think that the expectation that he would need a knockout punch based on polling is actually unfounded because the polls are very inconsistent. Yesterday, Rasmussen, which is a very reliable polling source, came up with a poll that shows him 3 points ahead nationally. So, believing that he's somehow way behind Hillary because of the polling, I don't actually agree with that. I don't think it's accurate. So I don't think the expectations of him at the debate were so high that he couldn't meet them. In fact, I think what he needed to do was pivot back to the issues, and he did. And he did an excellent job on every issue of calling her to task for her failings.
I'm always reminded of that a line in the movie The American President where the polling guy turns and he says, oh, you wanted us to poll registered voters?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, so many polling sites are calling landlines. And let's face it, a huge amount of voters don't even have landlines anymore. They don't do internet polling. I mean, there's a lot of deficiencies in polling. And in 2012, we had Romney, I think 3 days before the election, Romney was ahead, and he ended up losing by 5 points. So I just don't think you can trust polling one way or another, but believing that a candidate has to achieve a certain threshold based on polling is is not accurate either. I think Trump did a really good job. He answered the questions, and he pivoted every single time very effectively in many cases to where Hillary is deficient, because she's very deficient in many areas, and he pointed those out. I thought he did a really good job of that. And I thought she stumbled a bit, because it was a forum where, for the first time in any debate, she was really challenged, not just by Donald, but by the moderator. And she's not used to that. So I thought I don't think she handled it very well at all.
Well, I noticed Chris Wallace, when he was asking her a question about, I don't recall exactly what the question was, but she evaded the question. Not that that's new for politicians, but she evaded it and started talking about what was the Clinton Foundation and all the good things that the Clinton Foundation does. And he cut her off. He says, "No, that's not what we asked you. We asked you bing, bang, and bong." And then Donald Trump started talking over her, and we really couldn't make out what was being said. But I thought it was interesting that the moderator didn't let it go. And I think that there's been so much on both sides of the aisle over talking or diverting that it's like, we're not going to get through this if we keep it up, so we move on to the next subject.
Yeah, that's true. I think the job of a moderator, a debate is supposed to be presenting questions, having the candidates answer them, challenge each other, and the moderator is supposed to be the one who guides them through that process. They're not supposed to be debating the candidates.
No.
On either end. Of course, the first two debates, that's exactly what happened. They're not supposed to tailor the questions to improperly benefit one candidate over another, which, of course, is exactly what happened in the first two debates, and it didn't happen in the third one, which I thought was really good. And because it was a fairly presented debate, and the moderator did a good job, Donald Trump, when she was going off on the Clinton Foundation, he turned and said, yeah, the Clinton Foundation, which took money from countries which abuse women and abuse LGBT members, and they treat people horribly. You took money from those people, and you were fine with that, and now you claim to be pro-women. And she sort of stumbled, didn't know how to handle it. And then he talked about her pay-for-play schemes through the Clinton Foundation. I mean, these are things that, these are big issues. They're not small things. And she can pivot every single time to, but Donald Trump's a mean guy, which is all she says anymore. But it doesn't change those facts. And he had the opportunity to point them out because the moderator was giving the issues out there and letting the candidates challenge each other appropriately, which I thought was really good.
I think Saturday Night Live has had a field day with this election.
Yeah, they always do. I mean, they did during the McCain-Obama election, too. Remember, Tina Fey played Sarah Palin. And it's interesting.
And I remember Chevy Chase, his patented falling down was his imitation of Gerald Ford. Of course, that was before you were born, probably.
Before my time, Jeff. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. They definitely, Saturday Night Live skits affect elections. They do. And they affect the voters. There are people who believe candidates actually have said things just because they've heard an actor say it on Saturday Night Live, which, of course, is supposed to be comedy, and it's not factual. It's not a news report, but anyway. But, yeah, Saturday Night Live's had a good time, and Alec Baldwin has been very funny as Donald Trump.
You know, we talked about polls earlier, and, you know, I've done polling in the past. In a previous lifetime, I did a lot of – I worked for many candidates at the local and state and some at the national level. And polling is done for a multiplicity of reasons. Sometimes it's done to measure growth or decline on certain messages. Sometimes it's there are all different variables that come out of that. And I'm going somewhere in particular with this, so bear with me.
Okay.
When you do a local poll, what we would try to do is we would try to assess what the voter turnout would look like and how a particular candidate was going to fare as close to Friday, Saturday, or Sunday before an election. But beyond that, you wanted to be able to drill down to know in what wards and what precincts your particular candidate was ahead and by how much. And the reason that was important was the get out the vote operation. And the rule of thumb was if by 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the number, what your expected voter turnout was and what you needed to win, if your candidate, if that you weren't as close to that number as you wanted, on those precincts that you were 5 points or more ahead, you polled the entire precinct because you were, no matter, even if you were pulling out your opponent's strength, you were still going to be 5 points ahead. In the ones that you were 3 points or less in, you only pulled your voter ID out. So, which leads me to, how well do you see the Republican National Committee's get out the vote operation? And is the Democratic one a little better oiled and prepared for this election than perhaps the Republican one is?
Well, I guess we'll find out on November 8th. I don't know. I think traditionally Democrats are really good at getting out the vote. And part of the reason they're very good at it, unfortunately, is that there's some voter fraud that happens in many areas. And we find their candidates do very well in areas where we don't expect their candidates to do well because there is fraud. I do think that the Republican National Committee has made huge strides over the last 4 years because they found deficiencies in the get-out-the-vote effort in 2012, and they didn't want that to happen again. The Trump campaign has been extremely effective in being organized in states where I don't think they were expected to be. We saw that through the primary, where he is running against so many established politicians who had so many connections in these states. And, you know, generally speaking, you were discussing polling. When Trump was running during the primary, he was never polling as high as he ultimately ended up winning in many of those battleground states. So I'm guessing that the get-out-the-vote effort from the RNC and from the Trump campaign this election is going to be unprecedented and much more organized and coordinated than we've seen in the past. Will it be enough to overcome Hillary's organizational structure? We'll find out. I mean, she's been running for president for 10 years. I expect her to be very organized. If she isn't, then there's something really wrong with the Clinton campaign.
Well, what struck me, I was listening to one of the broadcasts, and they talked about the Trump kids, children had gone to, well, grown-ups, but his children had gone to the Republican National Committee and you know, were feeling like, where's the action? Where's the support that we were looking for? And the leases for the campaign headquarters in the key states and cities weren't even signed yet. And that was in, like, end of September, early October.
Yeah, unfortunately, there has not been as much support as there should have been. And there's not. I'm not gonna be on your show and claim that there's been a great coordination between high-profile Republicans and the Trump campaign. I mean, there clearly hasn't been. That's part of his appeal to voters, is that there just hasn't been a lot of support, and the Trump campaign has had to overcome a lot of hurdles that they shouldn't have had to, because Republicans didn't come out the way they should have for him and get behind him and gel behind him the way they should have. Again, I think they will overcome a lot come November 8th, because I really don't see the RNC not wanting to do what's necessary to defeat Hillary. And we'll find out. It'll be interesting.
And I think it was interesting. You just said the RNC wanting to defeat Hillary as opposed to the RNC wanting to see Trump succeed.
Well, I think that the reality is, and you and I have discussed this, the political establishment on both sides of the aisle are horrified by Trump, not because of what he says or what he does, but because he represents real change to the political class of this country. He is not a politician. He is not an insider, a Washington insider. He's not inside the bubble. He's different. That's why voters like him. And he's promising to shake things up. He came out this week and he said, we need term limits. It's enough now. We've had people on both sides in office for 50 years. It's ridiculous. And he's absolutely right. And voters feel that way. And, you know, what happens is we've created this hierarchy in our society, which was never intended by the founders of our country. And these people who go to Washington, they never want to leave, and they stay for years. I mean, Ed Markey's a classic example. He's been a congressman and a senator now for like 40 years. And so, you know, you lose
touch with reality when you're living in a bubble like that. And Trump represents a complete change. He's not establishment. He didn't come up through the ranks. He's, you know, everyone says, oh, he has no political experience. Well, that's actually a benefit. Because if you're going to change things, coming in with a fresh set of eyes and a different perspective, especially a private sector perspective, is a huge benefit to actually changing things. And things in this country are a mess. So,
well, I think the thing that scares the establishment in both parties is he's not reliant on money.
Exactly.
He doesn't have to lean toward the special interest to fund anything because he's got plenty of money, not unlike the Kennedys.
Well, exactly. He has plenty of his own money. He's raised a ton of money on his own, and he doesn't need the Republican establishment, and that really upsets them because they want to be needed.
Now, how does that change the Republican Party going forward if he wins or if he loses?
Well, I think he's going to win, and I think it's going to change the Republican Party a lot. And I think that these senators and congressmen who've come out and have publicly bashed him and haven't, you know, supported him, I think they're going to find that their electoral chances are people are going to remember that. I mean, the reality is the very first Republican primary debate, there were 17, or I think they had 10 or 11 men on the stage. I don't even think Carly Fiorina was up there, but they were all, you know, it was a bunch of them. And they were all up there, and the very first question was, will you all support whoever wins this nomination? And every single one of those established politicians said they absolutely would. And Trump said, well, I'm not sure. I'm going to have to see what the results are. And he was vilified for it. Well, now look what's happened. He got the nomination. A bunch of those people, they went back on their word, and they haven't supported him. And that's not, you know, that's how we're structured in this country. He won fair and square. He ran his campaign state by state. He won the primary. He is the nominee. And we should be getting behind him. And I think the establishment that doesn't want to because they're afraid of him, well, the voters don't like that. And I think that that's going to be reflected, you know, down the line.
It's almost as though the Republicans took a page out of the Democrats' playbook, because that's historically been a shortcoming of the Democratic Party. You get through the primary, well, we don't like the candidate. The candidate was more, was a moderate or a conservative Democrat. They picked a powder on him, and they let it, they said, well, we'll let it roll. We'll get the Republican in there, and then we'll tee off on him, and, you know, more on the state side than nationally.
Right. Well, but it's not a good, it's a strategy.
Yeah.
And I think it's a poor one because it's not, first of all, it's not Democratic. I mean, the Democrats had a horrible primary. They barely recruited anybody. They had Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Bernie was gaining steam. The DNC was colluding with the Clinton campaign to steal it from Bernie. That's not democracy. That's not how it's supposed to go. Someone is not supposed to be, you know, appointed the nominee. They're supposed to win because the voters want them. And Trump, he won it fair and square. And the establishment was shocked by it. But they should be, what they should be doing, instead of starting to defeat him or not support him or make his life harder, what they should be doing is saying, wow, what does that say about all of us? What are the voters telling us? They want an independent voice.
If we turn back the clock,
from a different perspective, and voters want that. They're tired of this.
If we turn back the clock to 1972, when Nixon was president, and they had the plumbers unit and the dirty tricks committee and the activities that were planned to create disruption, the fake letter that went to Muskie, the hiring of plan to hire high scale prostitutes to take the some of the people out on a boat and everything, or to kidnap rioters and, you know, drug them and leave them off in Mexico and let them find their way back. I mean, that was bizarre and off the wall kinds of things, not all of which happened, of course. But we've dipped into that pool this election, it seems, at least if you can believe what the WikiLeaks are suggesting.
Well, Clinton, you know, the Clinton campaign sending operatives, the DNC sending operatives to Trump rallies to incite violence so that she can go across the country and say, see, his rhetoric is inciting violence. It's amazing. And I'm, you know, I'm glad he pointed it out during the debate. He should have. Her campaign's out of control. And she's now being found out about it, and so she's floundering because it's really hard to explain. But she had no answer. She had no answer. It's black and white. WikiLeaks is exposing this, and she did. I mean, the idea that our democracy is affected this way by one campaign focused so much on the messaging that they're actually creating problems. They're creating, they're paying people to create problems for the Trump at Trump rallies so that they can then claim he's the one creating the problems is so crazy. They should be focusing on figuring out what's wrong with their candidate that people aren't responding to her. I mean, her rallies are so poorly attended, and his, the lines are down the street. So the reality is that it's been, you know, a lot of people have focused on Trump because he's a celebrity and have said, oh, it's a celebrity circus. Well, the Clinton campaign has sort of under the radar for a long time. They have been throwing these bombs out there and creating issues, and now it's being found out. And it really tells you a lot about their campaign and their candidate and how they've approached this entire election in a very negative way.
We got one, basically a minute left, and then we have to go to our next guest. But if Clinton wins, does the House, if it remains Republican, do they take the data that came out of the WikiLeaks and start looking at impeachment or investigations that lead to down that road? Or does Paul Ryan just say, enough's enough, we're done, and move on and make his own deals?
I think the voters would expect Paul Ryan to lead a charge if the president of the United States is Hillary Clinton and she's has a lot of criminal activity in her background, and the House and Senate aren't investigating that and doing the appropriate things to investigate that on behalf of the voters, then they're not doing their job, and people will expect it of them. There's a lot of outrage in this country over the behavior of the Clintons over the years, and especially Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation and the State Department and everything. I mean, she has so many scandals, scandal after scandal after scandal, and if she's sitting in the White House, well, she's still responsible to the constituents, and if she's doing things illegally, then that should be brought to light. So I fully expect, especially if the Congress remains Republican, that would happen, and it should.
Well, thank you again for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. We are not here next week, but we'll be in touch about our program on the 4th.
Sounds good, Josh. Have a great day.
Have a good weekend. Take care. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Treat at Sylvan Street, a great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. Treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Looking for a reliable place to produce your team's uniforms or your business's corporate apparel? Then Sauk Asian Sportswear is the place for you. Conveniently located on Route 1 South in Peabody, Mass., Sauk Asian Sportswear handles all aspects of your needs, from price quoting to providing visual proofs to production completion. Visit our website, SaukAsianSports.com, to view our monthly specials, vendor catalogs, and to request a quote. Remember, Sauk Asian Sportswear is the place to go.
Gloria Food Store is still Beverly's number one deli, and no matter what New England weather is thrown at us, Gloria is open. With fresh bread delivered from Sunray Bakery every morning, Gloria can provide party platters calzones, hot trays, cold trays, salad trays, and finger sandwiches for whatever you have planned. Call in your order at 978-922-3613, stop in at 268 Rantoul Street, or visit GloriaFoodStore.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Eileen Duff, who is a candidate for the Governor's Council and a local person. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Josh. How are you this morning?
Oh, just wonderful. A dreary day out there, but the sun keeps threatening to burn through. And usually start out, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your bio, and then we'll get into your race for the Governor's Council. And before we're done, I'm sure we'll get into the presidential race a little bit.
Oh, my goodness. Sure. Well, my name's Eileen Duff. I am a candidate for re-election to the Governor's Council. And I tell people it's the most important thing you may have never heard of. It is actually a constitutional office, which means we're in line of succession to the governor. It probably would never happen that any of us would become governor, the possibility exists. So I grew up on the North Shore and grew up in a family that was very politically active. My dad was very active in Democratic politics, and my mother was a member of the Eisenhower administration. So I grew up in a bipartisan household, and we were expected to be able to discuss the issues of the day at the dinner table, which was a really wonderful experience as a kid. My parents didn't fight about politics, actually. I never heard them have a fight about it. But we had really great, interesting policy discussions, frankly, for lack of a better word. And I was exposed at a very young age to the political process, not just as my father being somebody who had been on city council and school committee and those types of things, but, you know, my mother had many friends in the Eisenhower administration who then went on to be in the Nixon administration, so...
I need you to speak up just a little bit. You're fading on me.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a bad cell signal here where
okay.
I live in Gloucester. But, you know, I grew up around a lot of Democratic elected officials and also had the experience of meeting many people in the Nixon White House and had breakfast with President Nixon when I was 12 years old. So it was a great experience to learn both sides of the aisle. I went to college in Washington, D.C. I interned in the State House.
Can you turn your phone just a little bit one way or the other? You're low.
Can you hear me now?
Perfect.
Yeah. It depends how I move.
Yeah, no. Stay there.
I'll stay still. I'm not sure what part we were at, but I went to college in Washington, D.C. to study, government and in history and worked in Capitol Hill as a student. I also worked in the State House both as a high school student and then later as a college student. So one of the men that my mother had served when she worked in the State House was a fellow named Christopher Herter Jr. And Chris Herter Jr., many people know his dad became Secretary of State and was governor of Massachusetts, a well-known Republican. But Chris Herter Jr. was a member of the Governor's Council. So I always grew up knowing what the Governor's Council was and attending meetings and being really active, in state and local government. So that's how my interest in politics developed. As I got older, my background became more of a public policy background. I was recruited by the Clinton administration to work for an FCC commissioner in Washington, D.C. At that time, I was working in the public policy on the public policy side of telecommunications. And the commissioner I was assigned to work for was a Republican, Michelle Chong. And Commissioner Chong was not only the second youngest commissioner ever appointed, she was the first Asian American. So it was just a really great experience. And although I am a registered Democrat and active in the Democratic Party, I have a long history and reputation of working across the aisle very, very well and having a lot of friends on both sides. So it serves me well right now in the State House that I'm able to build consensus and have great relationships with folks.
Great, great. So what does the Governor's Council do?
We do several things, Josh. The smaller level things that people hear about on a more regular basis, we appoint the notary publics and justices of the peace. But the main task of the council is the final vetting process of judges. If the governor so chooses to put anyone forward for a commutation or pardon, we would also serve the same purpose, where we would review those cases that the governor gave us and determine whether, in consensus, we felt the person deserved to have that pardon or commutation.
Okay. That's great. I didn't realize that. That's neat. Have you had many cases where you've had to weigh in on a possible pardon or change of status?
Actually, in the last year of Governor Patrick's administration, he submitted one commutation in four pardons. And it was the first time in 17 years that any governor had done that. James Swift was our last governor that had done it. It used to be a very common practice. And, you know, I honestly think after the Willie Horton ads back in the day that governors got a little shy about issuing them, so they hadn't. I speak to, of course, frequently and meet every week with Governor Baker and his legal counsel, and they have indicated to me that they will also be issuing some at least pardons, and that they will probably come perhaps in his first term. He may not wait to the end of his term to issue them. So, you know, we'll wait and see. People have to apply for them. They have to go through the parole board. And it's a very, very detailed process to even be considered by the governor for one of these things before you even reach the governor's council. You really have to have a very, very strong case.
Okay, great. We have a little bit of time. We have some time left. What do you make of the races going on at the state level, and weigh in, if you will, on the presidential election?
Well, on the state level, there's a lot of state reps and senators and the governor's counselors who are up for re-election. We hope that people don't forget us because it's down ballot, and we don't have, a gubernatorial race this year or a U.S. Senate race. So, that's a little challenging for those of us that are not as well known. On the presidential side, like many people, I'm disappointed that the rhetoric has gotten to the level it's gotten. Whoever wins this race, I think there are a lot of lessons for us as Americans. And I think as a country, Josh, we really need to, we're going to have to come together and do a lot of healing. Because the fact of the matter is, and I tell this to people all the time, no matter what side wins, all of us want the best for our country. Because we're patriots and we love the United States. But most of us, it's really going to be our children and grandchildren that are dealing with whatever the residual effects are of either administration. So we need to think forward in what happens. But hopefully we will have a civil election and discourse, and whoever wins, it will be accepted by the other side of, what happens, and we'll just go forward. There have been many trying times in our history. We just haven't seen them like this in our lifetime.
You know what I found interesting was this question of accepting the outcome of the election, as if people had a choice. I know that the Bush and Gore campaign and that went to dragged on for 35, 36 or more days before they came to a closure, but once that was in, Gore said, okay, that's it. You won. Whether you won or not, we're going with the fact that you won, and that was how it went down. In other elections, you go back to Nixon Kennedy, very, very close election, but Nixon called him up and said, he conceded, and then of course some of the movies that were remakes of the era, the people, Nixon supporters, they stole it fair and square. You can't go after it. So yeah. Whether you believe it or not, I mean, but there hasn't been that as in and of itself is an issue, and so it's so that it is this time is kind of perplexing to me. Why is there such an expectation that? You know.
I don't know why. It's a really, really good question, and I think it is a great, you know, this, again, is not a party issue.
Yeah.
You know, every single vote counts. There were a couple of city council elections in Peabody, I think it was last year, that were decided by less than 10 votes. There was a state rep race up in the Newburyport area 2 years ago, decided by 14 votes. The losers of each of these conceded. And realized, you know what, I gave it my best shot, and I didn't make it. Maybe next time. That's how it goes. It is unheard of for somebody to say they won't accept the results. In fact, Gore, at a point, he could have kept challenging and decided it wasn't good for the country.
No.
This isn't just about us. It's about the country. And the fact of the matter is, there is very, very little voter fraud in the United States. It's almost impossible to create voter fraud. But, you know, people will be more aware and vigilant, and you know, I see no downside to that.
I have to share with you, years ago, I was involved in the Democratic primary here in Gloucester for a state representative. It was Bruce Tobey against Pat Fiorillo. And I said that Billy Moody and I were out checking the precincts to see voter totals and so forth. And I had spotted a couple of people from Brooks Brothers suits and from Boston or whatever, and walking into one of the precincts with Pat Fiorillo. And I leaned to Billy Moody and I said, "Just go along with me when I say this, right?" And as they got within earshot, I said, "So what name did you use here?" And the guy's head turned around like 180 degrees. They do that down here.
Yeah.
It was all in good fun, but it was. But there are the reports of the people living in cars that supposedly voted for Flynn and in Boston, and there are always those kinds of stories out there. How pervasive it is, and to what extent it's done in an organized way is really an unknown.
It's really a lot harder to do than you think it is, to be really honest. I know that. Yeah, and people need to recognize that. But the bigger issue, I think, is something that Senator Marco Rubio brought up. You know, he's up for election right now, running for re-election to the state, to the U.S. Senate in California. And, you know, he's a fairly conservative Republican, and he thinks it's outrageous that someone wouldn't accept the results because it really goes to the core of our democracy. And you know what? Hey, whatever it is on either side, at the end of the day, we're Americans.
You need to turn your head just a little bit, wherever you are.
Yeah. At the end of the day, we're Americans, and we need to support whoever is elected commander-in-chief. And, just carry on, because that's what you do.
Well, Pence has come out and said, previous to the last debate, and Trump's wife has said they'll accept it. And my sense is he does, too, but he doesn't want to play that card of inviting wholesale abuses, but my honest sense was he should have qualified his remarks as opposed to letting it drift. There's a different. I mean, there's a piece in promoting television that you want the cliffhanger effect to keep, but this isn't that, and I think that he needed to create some separation from that.
Yeah. We'll see. We only have a few weeks left, and I think afterwards everyone's going to, no matter what happens, we're going to all breathe a sigh of relief and get ready for our Thanksgiving turkeys and be happy for that.
Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on our Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Certainly wish you the very best in your upcoming election, and maybe after the first of the year we can have you back and you give us a kind of an update on what the Governor's Council is doing.
I will. Well, I hope that I win, and as I tell everybody on November 8th, get off your duff and vote.
There you go. That works.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There we go. That was interesting.
Yeah.
I think this is I think it goes back to you know, this is certainly the biggest circus I've ever seen.
In
my lifetime. And I started following presidential election right around Kennedy's time, but just before that, I was in grade school when Eisenhower was elected, and this is a zoo. It's absurd, and it's absurd how people are so dead set against one another. Now, Eileen Duff said something interesting. We should work together. I've not heard that from the other side. I've not heard it from anybody. And remember, I'm neither Republican nor Democrat, but I have not heard Republicans say, well, we have to work together. Never heard that.
No.
And that's interesting. I mean, I think that there are good, I know there are good people and good ideas on both sides. But in the last number of years, I want to probably go back to 2001, one party has worked to completely block the other party. And when Trump says, he screams at Billary and says, you know, you should have stopped me from tax loopholes and stuff like that. Well, how could she? Yeah. When Democrats, and she couldn't do it as a one-person, you know, senator, but Democrats, when they're in the minority, are completely blocked from that kind of thing. Republicans, when they're in the minority, in the last decade or so, have been completely blocked from getting any of their measures out. So, even, dare I say it, I mean, Trump hasn't said, we'll work together. He hasn't said that at all. I'll take care of it. I'm the one who can do it. Me. So that's a little disturbing as a voter. I'd like to see someone, and I go back, I think Kasich did say that. I don't think Bernie said that, but I think John Kasich did. Kasich said, you know, we have to work together. Am I wrong? Have you heard that publicly, you know, on the national level?
Not so much this time. Other times people will say,
years past. I'm talking about now.
But now, no, it's not. It's all very isolation driven, and the rhetoric is just beyond imagination. Hillary will say, I'm going to quote Michelle Obama, when they go low, you go high, and then fire off four insults. They're like, wait a minute. You know, and Trump doesn't call her on it. So, I mean, and I'm not being pro-Trump when I say that.
Well, I think my observation, what Billary does in those things is just rehash his behavior. I'm not sure those are insults. If he takes them as insults, then maybe he shouldn't act that way.
Yeah.
However, I think her character is extremely lacking, and I think to me, I just finished reading the book. I'm a late comer. Seven Habits of Highly
Stephen Covey.
Seven Habits of Highly Something or Other Effective People. I think that's the name of it. I'll have to go get it now on the break. And the whole book, the whole entire book of being an effective person. And meaning a good person when you read the entire book, and a good in a philosophical sense, is based on character.
Yeah.
And it's based on good character. And from afar, I mean, everybody's flawed, but boy, do I see bad character on both sides. I just see, you know, Billary's business deals are certainly questionable. Her deals in office through WikiLeaks are questionable. But then again, WikiLeaks, Russians, that's questionable. The whole thing is just absurd. And Donald Trump's behavior publicly is reprehensible. It's unbelievable. It's incredible.
And I'm not making excuses for him when I say certain things. What I would say is, I think when all is said and done, regardless of who's elected, it's important for the United States citizenry to step back and take a look at how this one played out. I said early on when we were going through the primaries that Trump and Bernie Sanders ate from the same trough. From a political perspective. But the other thing that strikes me is WikiLeaks are hacked email information that someone stole, and we're using sound recordings that were not supposed to be, and we're leading with that without verification. And we've become such a society through social media and other ways of going with instant information, that what was considered responsible journalism in broadcasting, even in the last election, has slid way down the line, it seems.
We'll be back.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at Historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
All right, we are back live now, and my pleasure to bring on Kate Fox. Can you hear me okay, Kate?
I can.
Okay, because I'm across the room here, and we're this is not the best setup in the world. But Kate Fox is the executive director of Destination Salem. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, but the question is, how are you in Salem doing?
We're good. It's not raining, and the vendors are setting up for the open market portion of the weekend, and I think it's going to be another great weekend in Salem.
All right, so here we go. Now, we are about two-thirds of the way through of an event known as Haunted Happenings, and I don't even know how to describe it, but how would you describe it to the rest of the world, Kate, for maybe who doesn't know what's going on in Salem?
Haunted Happenings is a month-long celebration of Halloween and fall in New England that is, we believe, the largest Halloween celebration in the world.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. Now, you've had a couple of weeks already, and could you maybe look back on a couple of highlights for us, Kate? Because I know that it doesn't make any difference if it's a Monday, a Sunday, or a Friday night. There's something always going on.
There is. I think one of the highlights was the pouring rain on that Sunday when it rained and a lot of us were able to stay inside. There were so many people on walking tours, and they were still out in droves in Salem, and it was testament to the enthusiasm our visitors from near and far feel for coming to Haunted Happenings in October. So, we had last week we had the MDA motorcycle ride, which some people love and some people less so. Thousands of motorcycles came up from Boston in a fundraiser for Muscular Dystrophy Association, and that was very successful. We've had the Grand Parade, which is run by the Chamber of Commerce, and there were thousands of people of all ages marching, and the theme was celebrating 100 years of parks and play, and the National Park Superintendent, Paul Dupre, was the Grand Marshal, so that was a successful evening, and just everything's been good. We had a fantastic a cappella festival on the 8th, the first year that we've done that, and I hope that returns in subsequent Octobers. And some of the a cappella groups have been coming back to perform on weekends. Part of the performance way we set up the festival was to give them all buskers permits that were good for the whole month. So we have some a cappella performers that you can find, along with all the other buskers who've been downtown on the weekends.
How was the parade, how was the turnout, and how did it go?
Parade was great. Thousands of people in it, thousands of people watching it, and it was a beautiful night, a perfect fall night, and some great floats, some of the most creative floats I think I've seen. The Salem Willows came in with a float that included a merry-go-round and a skee-ball machine, and there was one school march dressed as redwoods to celebrate the national parks. So lots of very creative additions this year.
That's amazing. Is there a theme? Kate, I know that you're probably not around town at night when all the costumes come out, but I've seen costumes in the daytime there. Is there any theme that you've seen or heard about so far this year?
Yeah, I'm seeing the usual mix of zombies and witches. One of the most popular things, especially for women, is not to fully commit to a costume, but to buy either a witch hat or a fascinator that has a witch hat or a spider or some other seasonally appropriate decor that they can wear on the top of their head, and then if they need to transition out of Halloween gear, they can do so easily. We see a lot of the hats and fascinators, a lot of zombie makeup. We have some really great makeup artists who are set up on Essex Street and doing up the makeup for people once they get here. But no, I haven't seen an overabundance of one or another type of costume.
I thought it might be orange hair or Chinese pantsuits. I thought that might
be in. I see where you're going with this, and I haven't seen it yet, but that's usually Halloween night.
Okay.
We see Halloween night is where we see all of the social political trends come out in full force. The rest of the month, it's a lot of traditional sort of witches and goblins.
Gotcha. We're talking with Kate Fox, who's the executive director at Destination Salem and Salem, and I get to talk with Kate on a pretty regular basis. Kate, as a side note, and this doesn't have anything to do with Halloween, and you may not even want to comment on it, but I know that there was a little bit of negative publicity that came out when that newspaper box was mailed, but that was bombed. But that was quickly turned around into something very positive, and the investigation has led to a couple of suspects who said that they were absolutely ignorant of the fact that that was an LGBT publication, that they just were looking for some kind of a joyride to bomb. From your perspective, Kate, and the business community's perspective, how has this been received? Because, as I said, from afar, from living outside of Salem, it looks like something that was very bad has turned into a pretty positive outcome.
Well, I commend the Salem community for coming together, and there was a vigil right after the Rainbow Times box was blown up, and we have a very vibrant LGBTQ community in Salem, and this week Salem was recognized on the HRC's list. They got 100%. Salem got 100% on the HRC scale as a LGBTQ friendly community, and that's a tremendous accomplishment. And it's not the first time that we've had 100%. So I think we focus on the good and move forward. And I did see the coverage about the vandals and blowing up the box. And I suppose sometimes an act of vandalism is just an act of vandalism. It's too bad that they targeted any media box, and especially one that has so much so many connections
Agreed.
Activities in the community. So I think, you know, you look at Salem throughout the year, especially in June during Pride, we have an active community that likes to come out and celebrate, but we are no place for hate. So we have all kinds of religious diversity, and everybody's welcome in Salem.
Absolutely, and you have a tremendous ethnic diversity as well, which I'm sure contributes to your different festivals and your different weekends and stuff like that. Is there any of that connected with haunted happenings? In other words, you know, a particular restaurant, an ethnic restaurant, or anything like that, or is it just, you know, everybody's just pitching in for the celebration?
Everybody's pitching in for the celebration. We have a lot of different cultural festivals throughout the year, but October is very Halloween and fall in New England. You know, the Harvest Fest is this weekend. That's a celebration of craft brew. That is a religion for some people.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad you brought that up.
it's really, we're just having fun.
Oh, tell me more about the Harvest Brew. I want to know.
It's the 10th anniversary, 10th year of the Harvest Fest, which is Saturday, and organized by the Shop Pamplemousse and craft brewers. Far From the Tree Cider is probably there. It's an incredibly popular event, sells out every year.
Okay. Kate, now I think the biggest thing, and I know I'm going to ask you to mention a few more highlights as we approach Halloween, but I think the biggest thing from a visitor's standpoint is getting in, parking, and getting out, or getting in public transportation, getting around, and getting out. So maybe you'd want to comment on that.
Take the train.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen numbers that have exceeded all projections the first three weekends of October, and the traffic and the gridlock that all of the numbers, the visitors are contributing to. We love that everybody chooses to come to Salem in October. We welcome them. We encourage them. We invite them. Take the train so you don't come with arrive with a bad taste in your mouth because of the traffic. And a lot of the parking garages and the parking lots are full by noon on weekend days. They've been filling up midweek as well. So even if people drive to Beverly, one stop to the north, or Lynn, two stops to the south, and use their parking garages and take the train in, they'll have a faster arrival to downtown Salem. And once you're here, everything's walkable. You park your car and you don't move it. I do discourage high heels because of the cobbles.
Yep.
Wear comfortable shoes and bring your Fitbits because you're going to put a lot of steps on them. But really, we can't say enough, take the train.
Well, you know, the thing is, a lot of people don't understand that Salem has it's a pretty dense densely populated community. It's not a big geographic area, so there isn't really a lot of parking space on a regular day. Plus, you've got the court activity, which necessarily requires most of the parking spaces on that part of town to be taken up.
Right. Well, we are a busy functioning city, and it's a city of 41,000 residents that welcomes hundreds of thousands of visitors in the month of October.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely going to be a squeeze and a pinch. There are a lot of lots that are open just for the month, and especially on the weekends. The Salem High School Band Boosters run a lot down on Bridge Street. One of the schools, the Bentley Academy School, runs a lot over on the other side of town. So there, and it's pay to park. So bring cash.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the lots are $20 cash on entry, and so if you do decide to drive in, plan for traffic, and I would take the first parking you see. And
okay.
All of this information is on our website at hauntedhappenings.org.
How many people do you expect this weekend or next weekend, or is it too much to say?
It's impossible for us to tell. I dream of a day I have a gate on the end of Salem, and I can count them all. what we do is usually talk to our attractions and museums and the visitor centers and see how we're trending to know if we're up or down from prior years. But a good Saturday in October with good weather like tomorrow, and you're looking at 75,000 to 100,000 people during the day.
Cowabunga, cowabunga. All right, Kate, finally, activities you want to highlight for either this weekend or the rest of Haunted Happenings?
Lots of family-friendly events coming on the next 2 weekends. Salem Common Neighborhood Association does their family carnival on Salem Common. We've got not very Halloween-y, but the old-fashioned baseball tomorrow on Salem Common. And we've the Harvest Fest I mentioned, the balls and parties are all mostly on the 28th and 29th, although there are a couple this weekend. Too many things to go through.
Mm-hmm.
We post on our social media printable PDFs, and it's all on the calendar at hauntedhappenings.org.
Okay. Is there a hot dog place that sells Halloweenies?
You're funny.
I thought that's where you're going. All right, Kate. Listen, have a great weekend, and thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. I know how busy you are.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Kate. Take care. That's Kate Fox, who was executive director of Destination Salem, and she's always gracious and very helpful when we stop over there Washington Street, I think it is, that Main Street where City Hall is, and tremendous. But it's incredible what goes on there, Josh. I mean,
oh, I know.
You can go in the middle of the daytime, and there'll be people in constant, like today.
Oh, I know.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I had to go to court not a year ago, in middle of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like,
What is it?
Yeah.
I think it was in, I don't know when it was, it might have been June or July last year, and someone was in costume outside, and I was interviewing Mayor Driscoll, and I walked in, I said, Madam Mayor, there's people outside in Halloween costumes, and she just shrugged her shoulders, put her hands up like this, and said, Salem.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool, but I think public transportation is the best way. No fake guns, no fake weapons, no baseball bats, nothing like that. And so far, it's been every single year, it's an extremely family-oriented, fun thing. Probably Friday night, next Saturday night might be a little bit more for the adults. But
I'll be interested to see what this new cable television show Salem does in terms of
who does that?
It's coming on one of the channels starting November 2nd, so it'll be after the Halloween, but it looks like it's going to be an interesting TV series.
All right, well, speaking of live streaming video, tonight it will be Peabody at Danvers High School Football, 7 p.m. Weather looks is pretty iffy, but I think we'll get the game in. That'll be on Channel B. We've got also on Channel B. We have another game over on Channel A, and what else do we have here? We do not have a game tomorrow. There is no game tomorrow. The football playoffs will be forming over the weekend, I believe, and we'll let you know where we're going to be next weekend. So don't forget football tonight, both games. Check out Bill Newell's football preview show, weekend football preview. You've got to listen to it. It's posted right now. Coaches up. It's just amazing stuff. All kinds of information and analysis with Bill and others. I believe John Squires, Steve Krause, usually a guesting on there. But check it out. It's posted right now before you go to the games. And tell people about it. All right, so
no show next week.
We're up next
week.
We'll
be back on November 4th.
All right, that's Josh Arnold. Our producer and engineer is Bill Proposky. I'm Rick Moore. Bye-bye.